Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on our most recent podcasts. We recently discussed the John Frankenheimer film Seconds. Before that was The Shape of Water. Before that was Annihilation. Before that was A Serious Man. And before that, Le Samurai. Themacguffinman.com. Check them out. Or don't. Anyway, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Some weird movies lately when you list them like that.
Got to keep the viewer on their toes, or listener on their toes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How does this combination fit in with the weirdness list?
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're discussing Point Blank and The Limey today. Mm-hmm. I was ready for Point Blank to be weird, and it kind of normalizes itself as time passes, but oh man, it starts off on quite the trip.
Yeah, I mean, within like the first 3 minutes, you've got somebody like fake freeze framing for the opening credits, and it's just wonderful. It's that sort of like weird off-putting stuff that just happens in this movie all the time.
Yeah. Oh, and I didn't know a ton about this movie, which can be very enjoyable to kind of go into something that you know it's well made by the fact that it's been successful and looked at. I mean, film historians talk about it being very good, but I just didn't know a ton about it going in, and just from the time period and the little that I did know about it, I was expecting it to be pretty wild, and I legitimately thought like the torrent was bad just the way it was jumping around and not really connecting anything. So that's a good feeling.
That's certainly a feeling I could get down with. I do remember the first time I watched this movie, because it was probably only like 5 or 6 years ago, and at the very beginning being like, oh, this is my kind of film. I'm into this. And I'm ready to enjoy it. And then the scene of him walking down that tunnel is obviously when I was just like, cool, this is a 10 out of 10 for me. It doesn't matter what happens for the rest of it. This is just a very
yeah. And so I think we start with Point Blank. We will talk about The Limey, and I imagine there'll be a bit of spillover between the two, but we'll talk about the movie that was created first. Mm-hmm. And is somewhat of an inspiration to the second one. We can discuss to what degree that statement's true later. That intro, I mean, it kind of grabs your attention in the way that we talked about with Le Samurai and some of these in Seconds. I think we probably talked about this too, that there's a kind of confusing that when done in an engaging manner, just kind of hooks you, that it's interesting enough that you want to understand what's going on. You know, if a movie loses you halfway through, I think it's easier to write it off. Whereas if it looks like it's thought out, but asking a lot of you to connect the dots, that's different. And I think this movie is weird throughout, but I get just my recollection of it, that there is still some storytelling things that are, you know, not straight down the middle, but it's pretty top heavy with some of that more odd storytelling, right?
Yeah, and also it's what you were saying earlier, in that it just sort of normalizes itself as it goes on. I think that's a big part of it, because some of my favorite moments in this movie happen towards the end, when Carol O'Connor shows up and we get the flashbacks to Lee Marvin, who was playing Walker, saying, I want my money, I want my money. And then it just shows flashbacks to him punching different people that he's punched on his way down this road. And just that moment where you get reminded of things that have happened, and you sort of start to see Walker sort of start to think a little bit more deeply about what he's been doing, just this very like charge ahead sort of manner throughout the movie. That is really jarring. Those cuts are really jarring, because partially because there haven't been any jarring cuts for a couple minutes. But I just think weird stuff, or like editing type decisions that are just unpredictable and uncommon, do occur all throughout this movie. But as you said, I think it just sort of normalizes itself so that you're more prepared for it as it goes on. Whereas, like you said, at the very beginning, you're not sure if there's something wrong with the film you were watching. You know?
Yeah, and I think movies who do sort of the same thing, that keep you on your toes, as you say, there is that normalization of things are a certain degree of weird the whole time, and you just get more used to that this is the kind of movie you're watching. Mm-hmm. And then you also get, and I think particularly this time period, sort of the psychological thrillers, that the form of the film is reflective of the changing psychology of your main character or somebody else in the movie, and that sometimes something can start a bit more normal and looking similar to the films you've seen before, and then there's a level of wear and tear that happens psychologically to the characters, and mm-hmm. I think that's partially what you describe when you've said that he's gone through all this stuff, and you get this montage of him punching all these people, and just this reminder of everything that he's gone through during the runtime of this movie. And I mean, it doesn't take place over a very long period of time, right?
I honestly don't have an answer for you. I think like the actual plot of this movie definitely doesn't, but there are obviously flashbacks that happen seemingly years before the meat of this movie happens. I'm never really sure what age Walker is in either the flashbacks or or the main timeline of the movie.
Just Lee Marvin always looking 70.
Yeah, exactly. Even though he only lived to like 63, he somehow always looked 70. And just like, I don't know, just him and Reese standing together, just never, like, you and I, like, look like we could conceivably be friends in real life. Like, him and Reese standing together looks more like a paternal sort of relationship. But yeah, it's just that sort of disconnect that doesn't feel like it makes sense, but 100% makes sense in this movie. But that's a long way of saying I don't know how long this movie takes place over, but I do feel like you're right in that it's something like a week or less, you know?
Right, and I think this also isn't a movie that his primary concern is empirical information, you know.
Yes,
it's just
true.
As I said, more of a psychological movie. It's more about the state of mind and what effect this has on people, and that's something I'll say about this and The Limey. I feel, I mean, when we talk about thrillers or especially heists and murder movies and things like that, I am very big on sort of the X's and O's of how you commit these crimes and what moves you have and what you put in place in order to, you know, get around guards or alarm systems and things like that. This movie and The Limey, I feel, is pretty short on those. I think there's between the two of them, there's a handful, and some of them are cool. But these movies aren't, and I think probably Point Blank even less, they really aren't about how do I get past this guy? You know, how do I get to this hallway? How do I unlock this door? As I said, it's more of this psychological thing, and even more specifically within that, it's very much just a willpower movie. Like, mm-hmm. Walker is going to do this. It doesn't make sense how much money it's for, or how much time it takes, or what, you know, how much time passes from front to back of this movie. That's very backseat to the vehicle that this movie is.
Yeah, exactly. And what you were saying about the movie representing, or trying formally to represent the psychology of what Walker's going through. Just going back to the fact that it's very top heavy. He's very confused at the beginning of the movie. Walker is, and he's sort of like piecing together, how did I get here? Where do I go from here? And the most lost we see Walker for the majority of this movie is at the very beginning. So it makes sense that, like you said, the editing and whatnot be top heavy, just like at the end, as he sort of starts to be like, what am I doing here? That type of editing comes back. Whereas in the middle, he's just heading just straight ahead. He's walking straight ahead. And he's just like, I want my money. I want my 93,000. Somebody's got to pay, you know, like just standard sort of revenge types of things. And like you were saying, this movie, both these movies are short on that sort of mechanics of the crime film that we both like. You definitely like more than I do. This is like,
that's like the Ocean's movies. We see a ton of that, like Soderbergh's versions.
Yeah. The mechanics of the camera is what I'm more interested in those.
Yeah.
and I like George Clooney way more than you do. But, Yeah, the thing I like the most about these movies, and I think now is a good time to refer to Point Blank as a noir movie or a neo-noir movie. I think you like noir movies just because they're noirs more than I do, whereas something like this, where it takes all of those things I like about noirs, but also throws in a lot of, I suppose, borderline confusing filmmaking techniques throughout the, just to sort of jar you out of this formula that you're used to. Just the fact that this is a boldly Technicolor film, you know, like the use of color, the close up with the pool behind as like bullets are being passed from hand to hand late in the film at what's Carol O'Connor's name? Brewster, at his place, that the pool is just so blue. All of those things are just so not what you expect from noir, but this movie still has the tough guy sort of noir thing that everybody likes about the genre. You know?
Yeah, and noir will have that subjective storytelling and maybe an unreliable narrator, and what you see on screen is not a total depiction of reality. I mean, even the reality within the film. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely correct that this just, it runs with those ideas and just has this, psychedelic infusion.
Yeah.
That, you know, the idea of maybe what I'm seeing isn't completely true, plus a 60s acid trip.
Like, yeah, exactly.
You know, it takes it that much farther. And
yeah, this movie is basically a film reel of the Maltese Falcon and a tab of acid put in a blender together and just see what happens, you know?
Yeah, and I hadn't really considered what you said about formally this movie becoming, you know, not completely predictable or classical in any way, because that's definitely not the case. But, you know, he asserts his willpower in a way that, from a meta level, this movie starts making sense. You know, like, he's able to forge ahead, as you said, in a way that even the formalist aspects of this movie become more apparent as he gets a better grip on the world, being able to assert what he wants to do.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And so you mentioned the actual number, the $93,000. I've seen that this isn't really a lot of money, and that's what makes it so interesting that he's trying so hard. But I don't think it's a kind of inconsequential amount of money either.
No, it's definitely not inconsequential, especially 1967.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I saw some people saying that he does so much for this like tiny amount of money, and that's what makes it so that there's something more in his character, because no one would do this for that amount of money. And I do think, just because of how reticent he is and how little we do kind of get to know about him, that there is definitely a lot below the surface, and there's motivation that isn't explicitly spelled out. Did you want to kind of address Walker as a figure as more than just sheer will, you know, not just willpower shaped like a 35-year-old, 70-year-old man, but as, you know, more of a dynamic, fleshed out character?
Well, I think the fleshing out actually doesn't happen until very late. And even then, it's a pretty broad sort of fleshed out. It's just, we're so used to, I mean, him being Walker, you know, like just sort of moving forward at all times. And it's just only at the end, when he sort of starts to have doubts, it seems to be the first time when we see him not know exactly what he wants to do. But for most of the movie, he just sort of seems either driven by principle or the fact that he is somebody who doesn't have a lot of options in life. Like, we don't know what he's got going on. It's probable this is the only way he sees that he can get money as well. Like, it's just sort of the thing that he has going on. He's got his gray and yellow and green suits and seemingly not a lot else, you know? And he feels wronged by his friend, so he wants revenge on his friend. He wants the money that he feels he is owed. And then it just sort of gets to a point at the end where he's just like, what am I really doing? You know, I'm kind of being used, just in the way that, in the way that Fairfax wants to use me, because Yost/Fairfax throughout this movie is like borderline just pointing him in a direction and saying, hey, punch this guy. And now go talk to Brewster, go kill, get me to kill Brewster. And it's just sort of at the end where he starts to realize, like, he thinks he's in charge and doing all of these things so that he can have some sort of agency. But he's realizing over time that both money has some sort of control over him. Like, that's what he says. I want my money, whether or not it's sort of a metaphorical desire to have that money or an actual financial desire is unclear. It's probably somewhere in the middle. And then he just sort of realizes, as he says, somebody's got to pay. It really feels like he's sort of starting to come to terms with the fact that he just keeps paying over and over again for decisions he made in the past, which is to say that the decision to rob that Alcatraz run at the very beginning with Reese and his wife, Lynn, that decision just keeps sort of, he keeps paying for that decision in how it has changed him as a human being and how he has just become, he has become Walker. You know, he's not ever at a point in his life, going to be at a point in his life where he can be the guy he was when he met Lynn on the flashback of the docks, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the, I mean, if anything, that's an overly detailed character arc for Walker, you know? But that's sort of the thing I see him going through. And the thing I like the most about this movie and Lee Marvin's performance in this movie is the way that we see so little doubt in a face like Lee Marvin's. And just the image that we have in our head as people that weren't alive. I mean, we were both born after Lee Marvin had died. In his heyday, we weren't alive, so we didn't have that sort of star image. But like over time, no matter what his actual career was like, his star image has boiled down to, if I see Lee Marvin in a movie, I assume he's going to punch somebody in the face. And I think that's what is really cool about this movie, aside from all the filmmaking techniques, is the doubt that we see and the fact that we see him have so little doubt for so much of the movie. And then as soon as he starts to figure it out, it feels like the movie's changed entirely, you know? And then there's only like 8 minutes left in the movie at that
point. Yeah. And I mean, one of the first things I said about him that is pretty much just embodies this idea of, you know, of willpower, sheer will, like just doing something by force. And I think what you're getting at is just that realization that he's always going forward, but he's been aimed in that direction, right? Like he's doing whatever it takes to get what is next logically, but it's not necessarily his logic. He's sort of been directed to do something. And when he realizes that he's sort of been a pawn in this thing is, you know, that 8 minute left mark where he actually asserts what he wants, not just what he's been led to believe.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of, one of the strengths of this movie in telling that story is how you don't really realize how like Yost is everywhere, you know, like anytime it seems like Walker doesn't quite know where to go, Yost just magically appears. And you only really start to put that together towards the end of the movie when you realize Yost is Fairfax. And I think that sort of reveal is cool. And I think it speaks to how well the movie is able to keep you on your toes, both through its various stylistic techniques and also with its focus on Walker almost exclusively. And I just think that's a real strength of the movie, is that you don't figure out that Walker's kind of being used until Walker figures it out.
Yeah, and even the name Walker, it has that, just that idea of moving forward. And I think that stylistically, you know, when we talk about these more psychological movies or maybe a 60s psychedelic movie, I think you get just that idea of like a trip out montage and something. And as we said, this definitely has a lot of those psychological elements, but as little as this movie is, as we said, kind of concerned about a lot of the X's and O's stuff, it is really propulsive in a way. And it's not just like, look at this weird trip out sequence for 5 minutes because it's visually very cool. Even though, like, I just think that those visual things that are interesting, are happening at the same time. And I think that like even just a quick example of sometimes it feels like it dips a little bit into flashbacks, or it kind of slows down with the small amount of sentimentality that is within this movie. We'll get the cut to the beginning of the nightclub scene of just a mouth screaming into the camera and, you know, just high volume and then the colors. And I think that scene is where a lot of my favorite stuff in this movie does come from, too.
It's
and
a great scene.
Yeah, it's just a sequence that has a lot of stuff going on. And some of that stuff we've seen before or after and some we haven't, and just combine in a very compelling way. And sometimes it's really funny and sometimes it's disgusting, but it's always very propulsive and engaging.
Yeah. And I think one of my favorite parts of this movie, Quick Moments, is happens in that scene that you pointed out, where we get the very first shot of the movie is a shot from that nightclub scene where we see Walker sort of taken aback, and there's that red light on his face, kind of like fireworks. And that's also the first shot of the movie. But that first shot of the movie is so quick, and you forget about it by the time you get to that scene, and then you see it, and it's just like, oh, I've seen this before. And it just sort of, it's really interesting the way that specific shot at the beginning really plays. Like you notice it immediately because it's the first shot of the movie, but then you also just, it's so quick and you don't get any context for it that it sort of falls out of your brain until it comes back again. And you sort of start to see it as like, I mean, it is a memory that you have. It's not a memory that's been in your brain for a long time, but it's not unlike we see so many of Walker's flashbacks. It's just we're seeing it on a smaller scale because it's only a 93 minute or whatever movie, you know?
Yeah, that hasn't been haunting us as long as it's been haunting Walker.
Yeah.
And I just because we have been talking about Walker and Lee Marvin a bit, I think it's important to talk about his role in the production of this as well.
Yes.
Do you want to do a bit of the history of that one? Or?
Sure. John Borman hadn't directed a film.
Director John Borman, director who I don't think John we've mentioned Borman. Yet.
Yeah. Who would famously direct Deliverance shortly after this. He hadn't directed a movie in Hollywood yet, and met Lee Marvin on the set of The Dirty Dozen, and Lee Marvin just seemed to happen to get along with him quite well. And Lee Marvin had just won an Oscar for Cat Bayou, so he was sort of at the peak of his ability to wield his own clout in Hollywood.
The good old days of Best Actor Awards for comedy musical western.
Also Lee Marvin in a comedy musical western. And so he just got to a point where he was able to get final cut. Like I think there was like decisions on casting and all the, and the script approval and all this stuff that Lee Marvin had control over, but it all essentially boils down to final cut. And he just sort of trusted John Borman enough that he said, okay, cool. I have all of these things. I defer them to John, you know? And so John Borman is now somebody who is making his first Hollywood movie and has total control over it, to the point where he's able to release Point Blank as his first Hollywood movie, which just seems so baffling to me. Like looking at this movie and knowing that it's a studio movie at all, it's just so, it's like hard to wrap my head around, but that was 1967 in Hollywood. There was a lot of acid going around, and sometimes people give Lee Marvin total control, not realizing that he would give it over to an acid freak like John Borman.
Yeah, I just love that story because of, you know, like a Lee Marvin or a Clint Eastwood, like just some of these rough and tumble guys who made their names in westerns and stuff like that. It's just so interesting that, you know, you know, everyone has firm opinions on something. They have these stances on certain issues. They want things to be told a certain way, but we just don't mix them up with the kind of artistic crowd that wants to talk all the time about their vision and what they want. And I just love that story of Lee Marvin saying, like, I know what I want, and it's this guy to do all of that stuff. Like he has these opinions, and he wants this to be a certain way, but he's not going to be the one to shepherd it around. He just delegates it. And I think that, I don't know, something about these characters who say so little in their films, and the film ends up being something like a Point Blank or a Dirty Harry or, you know, some of those very influential spaghetti westerns. These guys who you don't think are willing to kind of go out there and say much and have these artistic visions, but they just kind of allow someone to hitch their wagon to them, to use something of an apt metaphor, and create something that is so weird. I mean, I just think about the way Lee Marvin looks at the start of this. I mean, we talked about how old he seemingly always looked. He's a World War II vet already by the time this movie comes out. And we just kind of get wrapped up in this idea that people who look like that and have that history are so conservative and static. And for something for him to do, as I said, these aren't all his choices that he made, but for him to just hand everything over to allow someone like Borman to make all these pretty radical choices and make a very radical debut film, I think is fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there are many examples of stars sort of using their clout to protect films that they're in, that we've talked about on this podcast. But like you said, I don't know, the way that this movie turns out stylistically is pretty far from the image of Lee Marvin that we have in our heads, over time.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Whereas, like, Brad Pitt saying he's not going to promote Seven if they remove the head in the box scene makes way more sense with what we know about Brad Pitt, you know?
Yeah, and I just think that juxtaposition is very interesting just for the 60s and what this movie ended up being.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So is it odd that this is making it into the Library of Congress so late? Because Point Blank isn't a movie that I hear much about, and I understand that it's kind of been not necessarily reassessed, because I think the people who are smart who saw it kind of saw that it was something interesting, but it just, I mean, and maybe I'm just completely out of touch here, but it just doesn't seem like it's continuing to make a big splash. And I just want to know, kind of from a historical standpoint, why you feel that now is the time for this movie. And by now I mean the last few years.
I actually did not know it was in the Library of Congress, but that's cool. I also have never really looked over the list of films that are in the Library of Congress. It's entirely possible that it's a much weirder collection of films than what we're anticipating. But the idea of it sort of being, let's say the Library of Congress is a way to preserve things that the Library of Congress deems worth preserving, you can kind of understand why they would preserve this, because it's a movie that has remained very popular in filmmaker type circles. Like the people that, it's a director's movie, you know, like people that direct movies love Point Blank, and people that direct movies also have a lot of clout in helping things get remembered, you know. This movie partially is helped to be remembered because Steven Soderbergh mentions it in interviews whenever he can, because he's stolen so many of its ideas over the years. And that type of thing, I think, makes sense as to why it would be chosen, just because it feels weird to call these people the cool kids, because they're kind of the nerds, but like the Hollywood equivalent of the cool kids, you know, over time, like historically, it just sort of makes sense to listen to the people that are able to be like, no, this, it's very cool stylistically, it's worth remembering. And it's also a cool way to remember Lee Marvin, who is a name that still gets remembered without necessarily attaching a film to it, you know, like a specific film.
Yeah. And I think as time passes, I mean, we've talked about this Chuck Klosterman idea that genres and subgenres kind of get remembered by one person. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's probably going to be Clint Eastwood, maybe John Wayne, who holds on to the Western, and Lee Marvin's going to fade. So it's nice that there is something like this that's very much his that can stick around. And the mandate of the Library of Congress is something like to retain films that are aesthetically, historically, or culturally significant. Mm-hmm. And I think just from a historical standpoint, I mean, I agree with everything that what you say, that if it's influential to people who continue to be successful and continue to shape culture, then, you know, by that fact alone, it's important in at least one of those three ways.
Yeah.
And just that it's such a product of its time. Like, you can't find 20 seconds of this movie in a row that you're not like, yep, 60s, done. Like, it's and you know, it's, you know, the styles of clothes and things, you know, architecture and things like that help, but it feels that way. And so as a kind of a time capsule of a time period, it's not historically important in the sense that it's showing events from the 60s that we all remember, but just the aesthetic and the storytelling of it, I think, just fits in that period so well.
Yeah, 1967 is kind of the unofficial beginning of what would become the American New Wave as well. Like, this is the year that The Graduates released, Bonnie and Clyde's released, and those are two very important films in the history of Hollywood. They kind of dictated how the next 8 years of Hollywood would go. Mark Harris wrote this really good book, Pictures at a Revolution, about the five best picture nominees in 1967. Those were two of them. Dr. Doolittle was one of them. And a Sidney Poitier movie, I forget which one. But anyway, and one other movie that I'm forgetting entirely. Really spectacular book, but it's just sort of about the place that Hollywood was at, where it was either like really commercial or really weird and still somehow commercial, you know? And I think Point Blank, just as a signifier historically, I think you can just sort of see, you can see its footprints on movies that we came to know as classics, but we just weren't, I'm speaking hypothetically, like as me hypothetical me in 1967, we would eventually be ready for this type of stuff, but only because of the type of decisions that people like Borman and Mike Nichols and Arthur Penn made in their movies in 1967. Yeah.
Yeah. And, should probably move on to the Limey soon, but I'll say one more thing while we're kind of on the historical notion is Vietnam. And I think that the history Lee Marvin has with being a World War II vet and just those ideas that we're talking about, that we talked about earlier about, you know, kind of being forceful and thinking you're doing what's important, but kind of being directed that way. And maybe it's not something that you believe and you kind of in the end, you feel more like a domino that I'm not saying that this is necessarily in mind of the people making this, but I think that that's something that would resonate in years to come when looking back at Vietnam as well.
Yeah, exactly. And also just the idea of, you know, again, that somebody's got a pay line, the who is in control sort of thing. The idea that, you know, again, wasn't alive. Presume there were way fewer draft dodgers in World War II than there were in the Vietnam War. And just the idea of people being less trusting of those above them and trying to remain aware of who the metaphorical Fairfax is at any given time, you know, and whether or not they should actually be trusted.
And what about the idea that Walker never really kills anybody in this movie?
I think it's fantastic because when we get to that point at the end, there's that one moment where Carol O'Connor, whose name again I keep forgetting, Brewster is at saying, you know, what do you really want? And we get him saying money, and then we get that cut back to flashback to the storm drain scene where the sniper shoots these two people thinking one of them would be Walker, and we see the person get shot again, the car dealer, but right before that we see a slow motion shot of Lee Marvin of Walker firing his revolver in what was the slow motion version of him shooting the bed at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And like that cut is so important because it's like Walker didn't kill this guy, but Walker killed this guy, you know? And I think that's why it's so cool that he never actually physically kills anybody in this movie, but he definitely kills people in this movie. And I think that's part of that's the realization he's coming to at the end of the movie, is that no matter what he tells himself about whether or not he actually physically killed somebody, Reese is dead because of him, that car dealer is dead because of him, so is the other guy that was in the storm drain, just all of these lives are ended because of what Walker does. And you know, he doesn't, his hands aren't clean.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, I mean, to piggyback on that, I think it serves two purposes. I think that there's this idea that culturally, you can be sort of complicit in something, you know, even if you weren't doing something, if you're part of a society that allows or, enforces certain things that in a way you are complicit to it. And that's, you know, I think a bigger 60s, 70s idea about America's role in the world. And, you know, being so close to the civil rights movement, just the way people got treated within America, that everyone's sort of complicit in it in a way. And to look more just sort of within this story, that Walker is trying to get out of something in a way. Like we talk about him pushing all these things and pushing himself forward and making things happen. But I think he realizes that this kind of highlights there's a system in place and that these violent, greedy people, and his job is to sort of get out of that, and these people will continue to kill each other, and that this circle of violence will continue, and his job is to slip out of it in a way. And he can't stop these things. It's not his place to stop these things, but by sort of extraditing himself from this problem, he's not really as complicit in it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And one last thing that I just want to talk about with Point Blank is the way that it treats domesticity. And I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, Lynn's life goes off the rails because of decisions that Walker's making as well. It's not like she's totally removed from these decisions herself, but, you know, if as a couple they made smarter choices, then maybe their lives are way less terrible. And I think the way that this movie depicts domesticity, it happens very, very briefly and not all that frequently, but I really enjoy it. I mean, Lynn and Walker have a shattered relationship anyway, but as we see throughout the movie with Chris, who is Lynn's sister, the Angie Dickinson character, her relationship with Walker is a little bizarre, but the way that the movie shows them together throughout, I think it's just really cool. There's that shot early on where I forget where she's going, but he has just slept on the couch at her place, and she's standing on a level that's above him, and he's looking up and saying, you know, do whatever you've got to do or something. And they're just framed in this interesting way. He's in the bottom left corner, she's in the top right corner. And later on, we get this shot that I'm sure you remember of Walker looking into a mirror that's on the floor that's been shattered after her apartment's been trashed. And it's the reverse. He's in the bottom right and she's in the top left. And it's just sort of like, this is the domestic life that he could have had, but it's been shattered, you know? And that's where it's notable that she is Lynn's family, you know? Like, it's just somebody that's so close to the woman that he was married to, and that has just sort of been shattered. And it's just this type of life that he can never have. And when they're in the house, what's Brewster's house towards the end, we see all these, you know, she gets invited into this house. She says, but nobody lives here, you know, because Walker can't live in a house like this. He just can't live in a sort of domestic house. And a shot that's really cool later, soon after that, is when she, in the span of about 5 seconds, somehow turns on every appliance in the kitchen. And it's just sort of like all of these domestic signifiers are just going haywire. And it's just because Walker just can't have a type of existence where, you know, this normal domestic relationship, just because of the decision he made to rob the Alcatraz gun run.
Yeah. And you did some of the heavy lifting there for me, so thank you for that. But you said that you want to talk about domesticity in this movie, and I thought about it, and I got left with the sense that a domestic lifestyle like that is attainable but temporary. Like I feel, and when I say you did some of the heavy lifting, is that I, even thinking about this beforehand, I wasn't able to quite articulate what they did to leave me with this feeling, but I just get this idea that it is a positive force, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, it's unsustainable. And I think it's hilarious that the only time we see Walker smiling is in flashbacks in this movie. Yeah. Shout out to Bourne Trivia as well. but that's, and I know I'm not articulating this properly, but I knew that I wouldn't be able to, is that I get that sense, and you've been able to articulate some of that for me, just that it is something that is wholesome and positive, but ephemeral. And
yep.
I think that lines up with the time period we're talking about, but that's kind of the way that I feel this movie left it. And I think that that scene of, you know, every labor-saving device that's going to give us enough time to love each other and form a good nuclear family going off at once and creating this awful sound, I think that does a good job of conveying that idea.
Yeah, exactly. And what you're saying about that it can be sort of temporary, even aside from Walker's relationship with Lynn, is the other brief instances when we see any sort of relationship in the movie, the gay couple that Walker makes tie themselves to each other. I don't have much of a reading on that other than Walker's just using them to get what he needs. But there's a couple in a diner that him and Chris are in later on in the movie. It's right before they go to Brewster's. Where we just get this one shot of this couple that are holding hands but not looking at each other. They're both staring off into the distance like they're just totally blank faced. And I think that sort of speaks to what you're saying in that the sort of like temporary sort of existence of these types of relationships. Like eventually you just sort of get to a point where you're holding hands in a diner and staring off into the distance because you've run out of things to do and tell each other, you know? And so, yeah, I think, I don't know. I don't think the movie has a like strong position on a domestic lifestyle. I just sort of, I think the way that it comments on it in a type of movie where you wouldn't expect that at all is worth noting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, is it Chris and Carter? Is that his name? The guy who has the penthouse?
Maybe. Isn't it Reese with the penthouse?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just, even that, like, it's one of the, to call it a relationship, I think is, I think, underselling the notion of relationships.
Yeah. But
there's that, I mean, that is so, you know, there's such an ulterior motive there, and the way that he's up on the penthouse and he has all these guards around, it just gave me the sense of like a performance. There's something so performative of it, like they're on a stage or on television. They've got these big glass windows and they have, you know, what looks like them coming together and seduction or whatever, and then behind closed doors, behind drawn curtains, the darker reality and the violence ends up being made apparent. And I'll feel bad if we don't mention Reese's naked fall from the balcony and 1960s special effects.
Yeah, well, on the I listened to a commentary track with John Boorman and Steven Soderbergh, and Soderbergh's asking how they did that effect, and Boorman explains it, and he's just like, yeah, but it's not good. It's an optical, but it's not a good optical. And opticals are what they called like special effects. And like dissolves and stuff, but yeah, Boorman agrees.
Yeah. I know. I figured he would. He's too smart not to.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure this won't be the end of Point Blank discussions because we'll bounce back and forth. But with mentioning Steve Soderbergh, I think we can move to the Limey and talk about that and the comparison between the two.
Yeah. I would love to do that.
You know, podcasting or not, I would love to talk to you about Steven Soderbergh.
Exactly.
Strong influence.
Oh yeah, for sure. Again, in that commentary track for Point Blank that I just mentioned, Steven Soderbergh says, "I watched Point Blank a lot in the lead up to shooting in The Limey." Like, it's just a clear influence on The Limey, and also a clear influence on Steven Soderbergh's whole career. You know, just making genre movies in ways that are inspired by weirder movies. You know, and The Limey is a very simple movie that makes some very showy choices that I think sort of help end up separating it from the movie it could have been, you know? Because if you just sort of imagine this movie just chronologically and just told like a normal person would tell this movie as opposed to Steven Soderbergh, it just seems like, I can't imagine it would be entertaining, you know? Like, it just seems like it would be so boring.
Yeah, I guess on paper it's kind of the same thing as Point Blank, right? Like, it's just this one man who feels wronged and has to go to this place and try to track down the people responsible and get vengeance. I mean, it's just the vengeance plot, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, no, exactly. and the conclusion they come to at the end is very similar in both cases.
Yeah, and you know what? I actually liked the... it's not much of a reveal, I guess, but the notion that we get left with The Limey, I mean, we can, maybe we shouldn't get right to the end, but that idea that Jenny was the same person as a child as she was as a grown up, and the information that the characters in this movie have isn't complete, and basically just the viewer is the only one who knows most of the story by the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But, you know, and at the end, just as much as is ever going to come together for Wilson comes together, and it just sort of illuminates what he's been doing. You know, that just reminded me very much of Point Break, or Point Blank, sorry. Yeah. It was bound to happen at some point, but there is no surfing in either of these movies.
I'm so glad it wasn't me. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so this is 32 years later. Point Blank to the Limey. Mm-hmm. And I think, I mean, you touched on it, that it's this revenge plot just told in an interesting and compelling way. And that's what makes the difference. But I think they not go off the rails, but I think they choose, let's say they take the road less traveled in different ways. I mean, there's not a ton of psychedelia and the Limey, but they kind of they adjust normal storytelling techniques. Is it just editing, or what do you think it is that's so different about the form that the Limey takes that separates it from the on paper version of a revenge plot?
A lot of it's editing, and the decision to shoot a handful of conversations in different locations and cut those together. One of the things that I think is the most jarring, I mean, it's been so long since the first time I saw the Limey now that I'm kind of just trying to remember, and I may or may not be right, but I remember finding it jarring that first conversation he has with Luis Guzman, Eduardo, towards the beginning of the movie when they're in his backyard, and then they're in a car, and then I don't remember where else they go. And the same thing happens with Leslie Ann Warren's character, Elaine, a couple times. And I wasn't sure if, like, and by that point, I know enough about filmmaking to know that it's possible that this movie was way longer and then was compressed and they're cutting all of these scenes together. I learned pretty recently that the way they did that was they shot the same scene in just a handful of locations and then just cut them together. And the idea that I don't really find is something that lines up with how I remember my conversations. But the idea that, as Soderbergh explains it, is it's sort of like when you're thinking back about a conversation that you had, you don't quite remember where you were at the time. You remember where you were at the point of the day, or sorry, throughout that day, but you don't remember if you were, say you were at Eduardo's backyard, and then later you drove somewhere else. You couldn't remember if this part of the conversation actually happened in the car or the backyard. And that's the idea that they were trying to convey. But the first time you watch this movie, you just kind of assume that it's multiple scenes like squished together, and it just sort of is like, what is happening? It's hard to wrap your head around. And the first 12 minutes or so of this movie is just really, really like hard to wrap your head around for those sorts of things, basically leading up to when Wilson goes to confront I don't know, whoever those warehouse thugs are. Nothing's ever really that clear. But all that stuff in the first 12 minutes, it's jumping around. We see Wilson walk out from an airport, get in a cab, go to a hotel, and then turns on the shower, and then we see bits and pieces of like 14 different scenes in rapid succession, you know? So those types of things are editing, but I'm sure the flashbacks and stuff like that were things that would have been in the script. And those are some of the things that I think are so, so helpful for this movie. And especially towards the end of the movie, where I think the last 5 minutes of this movie is incredibly effective. And I can't give all the credit to Mr. Soderbergh on that one. I just get the feeling that the flashbacks would have been in writing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, in talking about crediting / blaming certain people, it is very entertaining listening to the commentary and, you know, Soderbergh referencing criticism about how underwritten the characters are and how, you know, he didn't write it. And, you know, that's Dobb's problem, and all the good things and all the bad things can be split up to who actually did them. Or I think as a basically a result of auteur theory, it's all Soderbergh, right? It's in a way it is that there's nothing was going to be in this movie that he wouldn't allow in this movie, just by kind of where he is and who he is at this point. But it was very illuminating to hear him talk about that distinction and them kind of have to fight over who should get credit for what, and what's in the screenplay and what was decided. And they've clearly worked together a lot, you know.
They've made three films together now.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. Not necessarily that they've made so many films together, but just the nature of how much time you have to spend together to make a project like that, from my limited understanding. They just slip in and out of kind of joking, kind of sarcasm, kind of extremely serious. And
I mean, Soderbergh calls Lem Dobbs illiterate at one point.
And I think it's, you know, the way that they speak to each other so casually and then so formally, I think that they're there for work. You know, that's why they're recording this commentary. But at the same time, when you're left with one other person for 90 minutes, that you know pretty well, things are going to be a lot more casual. And the way that we talked about Point Blank being more interested in the psychological journey, more interested in what it felt like than you know, what a cop would want, you know, certain times and locations and very empirical data. This is the same thing. Like we have, as you said, these conversations, you can't pinpoint exactly where they happen, but you remember how they made you feel. And you remember, you know, when you had a shower the next morning, you maybe don't know exactly where Eduardo revealed what bit of information, but you know how it affected you and what you thought of it. And I think that visually, it's less experimental than Point Blank, but it tries to achieve those same things through stylistic means, and I think it's successful at it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just going back to the commentary track for one moment that I think really explains something or illuminates something in the auteur theory that I certainly sort of on the side. Anyway, like Lem Dobbs talking about how that shot where Wilson goes back into the warehouse to shoot the guys that have just thrown him out, how it's that one shot, and we don't follow Wilson into the warehouse. The direction to not follow with the camera is in the script, and obviously that's something that reviewers would have credited to Soderbergh, because it's such a Soderberghy move, for one. Even in when we're just in 1999, just the guy that made Out of Sight would totally make that decision, you know? And
well, it's a camera movement. You just don't.
Exactly. Yeah. And just the fact that it just gets credited to Soderbergh, even though it was in the screenplay, I think that sort of thing is really illuminating. And I think a couple of the points that Dobbs has are right. And it's funny that I disagree with him so much, just like I disagree with Steven Soderbergh a lot, especially the promotional, or the very brief promotional tour for his most recent film, Unsane. He's been saying a lot of things I do not agree with. I don't know, just the way that their conversation goes, they're two people that will clearly say what's on their mind and are at a point where they don't have to hide what they think anymore. I think they surely would have had tons of arguments over the course of the making of the film, but at this point, you can step on all the toes as opposed to leaving one unstepped on so that you can maintain the relationship, because you never know.
Yeah.
Even though they are talking about potentially working again over the course of that commentary track. But I just think the way that that conversation goes, I find it really illuminating to both the filmmaking process and how the writer is often totally forgotten. And we just give, in almost every instance, we give... And this is true of so many things. Like, we give credit to the most famous name, unless that the most famous person is widely hated, and then we give them all the blame. But I just think that, like, their conversation is really illuminating for that type of thing, especially as somebody who thinks about the auteur theory a lot, and realizes that, like, I'm willing to come to terms with the fact that, like, it's not the best way to talk about a movie, but in with the amount of detail we are actually able to get about the making of movies, it's the most efficient way to talk about it. And I just think their conversation is really interesting and illuminating to people like myself. And that's why it became such a famous commentary track, to the point where, like, in conversation with you, I said it might be more famous than the movie at this point. You know, it's got that same sort of, like, internet famous, that sort of vibe to it, that a lot of, you know, Point Blank people would remember the Limey commentary track, you know. And from that 10-year period where there were a lot of good commentary tracks, or when the commentary track was actually a thing people took the time out to do, it might be the most memorable one of the many that I've listened to. You know?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that for this movie to be the source of it, and the way that we've been talking about this in Point Blank, it's, you know, we'll think about that one conversation that we've kind of been using, where Eduardo teaches Wilson a lot about what happened with his daughter, you know, trying to fill him in. You know, for example, we're saying we don't know exactly when he learned this or where he learned this, but it all kind of comes together and it ends up being this one conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with this film, right? Like, we're not as concerned. I mean, for better or worse, we're not as concerned with necessarily who was in charge of what idea, or who is the genesis of this notion that everybody ran with and reviewers kind of loved. It kind of gets all lost in the wash, and you experience it as one thing. And I think that it's interesting that this commentary is so emblematic of that. And these are the exact kind of notions that this movie plays with. And I think, those are what draws people to this movie. I think that there's good things about it, but I think that's one of the takeaways, is not the story, but the storytelling.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a line that Wilson has pretty late in the movie where he says, he's talking about Jenny, and he says, "I watched her grow up in increments." And I love that line. And it also kind of represents the way that it feels like watching a lot of this movie. It feels like, I mean, you could say any movie is kind of incremental, in that every scene is an increment. But just the way that it feels more broken up than so many other movies. Like, so many edits are just, like, obvious edits. And, you know, the thing that I say so frequently on this podcast is that good editing is editing that isn't noticed. You know, like, you can't go a minute of this movie without seeing an edit and just be like, whoa, that was an edit, you know?
Yeah.
Especially the conversation Wilson has with Bill Duke, the DEA officer, in the second half of the movie. That's, like, his monologue is just, like, every line there's an edit. And it just, no, like, there's not another movie where it makes sense to do that, but somehow for this movie it makes perfect sense, you know?
Yeah. And I with that reservation, I can give this movie the most editing award.
Oh, absolutely.
And the fake sweeping award for homeboy sweeping up in the warehouse, like, in the middle of a hallway.
It's so good.
Clearly doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it's pretty great. But yeah, he's really committed to holding the broom, and I respect that about him.
I feel like we're just gonna have to lean on the editing, just because it's so central to this. We get editing to the point of contradiction. Like, we see reaction shots that occupy more time than that amount of time passed in the conversation between when that person spoke twice. Like, we have this there is that idea of combining three conversations into one, and maybe your memory kind of blurs them all together, but we have, like, what is a contradictory use of space time in this. And I don't think that that's an oversight. I think that there are certain things that you learn, or certain things that you do, that occupy more time in your brain and your memory because of the significance of it. And I think that that's an example of the form doing some of the legwork for the narrative.
Yeah, I agree. And talking about form doing some of the legwork for the narrative, I think, or I guess it's less narrative as opposed to, I suppose, final meaning of the movie, or what we're supposed to feel like Wilson has running through him at the end of the movie. I love the flashback, the silent flashbacks to Jenny's life, both as an adult and as a child. I don't know what filter they use to sort of like add streaks to that footage, but through so much of the movie, we're kind of like Wilson is thinking back to Jenny as a child, and then learning things about Jenny as an adult to sort of get to a point where he knows what happened to her. And all the flashbacks that we see him seeing of Jenny's life are they're blue, they're tinted blue, and we get to the end of the movie where he confronts Terry Valentine, played by Peter Fonda, in a very entertaining performance. But like when he's confronting him on the beach after Valentine has broken his ankle. Also, I should say that is also the ending of Haywire, the next movie Soderbergh and and Lem Dobbs made together. But that's neither here nor there. But when he's talking there, and we finally get to the beginning of the movie, because the first line is "Tell me about Jenny," over a black screen, and we can hear the beach. And now we sort of get to a point where we actually see what's happening, as opposed to just hear it. And we see Wilson in this very sort of blue night at the beach. And it's just, the color is blue. And then every flashback we get of Jenny at that point now, as things are coming, you know, he's starting to understand them more, those flashbacks are now sort of orange or red. And it's the idea that even as much as he's catching up to Jenny, they can never totally be in sync because of decisions he's made in the past. And I think that sort of dichotomy, like, you know, he's catching up to her, he gets to a place where everything around him is blue, but then she's in this orange red sort of filter now. And I think that's really cool in showing that no matter what he does, he'll never be able to totally catch up to Jenny. And that combined with the fact that the very beginning of this movie, when the title card of the Limey comes on screen, we see Wilson walk into focus. It just says the Limey. And then he just, you know, starts going, getting to his hotel and all that stuff. Then we see him on that beach, and we get that same sort of close up of him, and we see him walk away, and he walks out into focus. And I think the idea that he gets off this plane and walks into focus is meant to be like, he gets off this plane and he's like, okay, I have to kill the person that killed my daughter. And he gets to a point where he's like, what have I done that sort of already led me, that has made me kind of villainous in some capacity. And it's just sort of this, he's been thrown in a sort of disarray, and he just sort of walks out of focus. He doesn't know who he is anymore, or his decisions, what his decisions have led to. And I think that's something that's really cool. And also the decision to use footage of Terrence Stamp in a movie from the 1960s, Ken Loach's Poor Cow, is really cool. And that sort of combines with all of these things to sort of get to a point where, like, we've seen so much of Wilson, and we just get to a point where we're just like, okay, we don't even know. You know, like, we've learned so much, and he sort of started to learn so much about himself, and he just walks right back out of focus. And then the last thing we see of him in this movie is a clip from the movie Poor Cow of him performing a song. And it's just sort of this very simple moment. He's singing about people loving him and freedom. And it's just sort of like, it just makes the movie so sad, that last like 30 second clip, because so many sad things are about to happen to that family, mostly because of Wilson's decisions. You know?
Yeah, I secretly, my favorite part of this movie is those cuts to a different movie of Terrence Stamp.
Yeah, it's great.
It's so good to me.
It's amazing how like perfect the clips work too. Like, I don't know. It just seems, it feels like they were written into the movie, you know. And I think I might have even thought that they somehow like did some sort of weird thing to DH Terrence Stamp or something and shoot some footage, because it just fits so perfectly. You know, you've got everything you need for Wilson.
No, absolutely. And just, yeah, I think the idea of time and temporality is so important to this movie. You know, Wilson is obviously hung up on this time that he lost with his daughter while being in jail. And we talked about this with the Social Network podcast, that idea of using something, using a lens where you go in and out of focus so quickly, just the idea that there's a certain time and, you know, kind of space that if you're not in it, you've kind of missed it. And I think that those scenes of him walking in and out of focus like that remind me of that. And just this notion of timing being so important and kind of inescapable. And that ties in so well with them using this old this footage of him as a younger man. And I think that it's outside of the film and more of a meta context, the idea that they say this is probably the only movie we could have used. Like, if he didn't choose to be in this movie, we would have no good footage of him, because even though Terrence Stamp was a prolific actor around this time, he was always doing period pieces or something where he's wearing a costume or he has a big mustache, and it would just stand out as not making any sense of him being a young man in the 60s in England, or when it was 60s or 70s at that time. And I think that that kind of stroke of luck that is so tied in to timing and happenstance adds so much. And obviously you don't know that watching it the first time. And I thought it was emotionally effective the first time around, not knowing that. And then you find that out. And I don't know, that is something that adds a total layer to this for me. And yeah, that notion of lost time and things having to exist in a certain window, and that this leans so much on Point Blank. And I mean, we'll talk about Fonda, and like, Point Blank is present in this as an influence, but I think that the 60s in general is something that plays a role in Fonda and Wilson's history inside this movie, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They describe Terry Valentine as somebody who like bottled up the feeling of the 60s and profited off of it. I think that's something Elaine says.
Yeah, and even when they point out it's like it was late 65 and early 66, or it was
late 67 and beginning of 68, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's...
Or sorry, 66, 67, my bad.
Yeah, just something about, you know, we kind of talked about this with Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood, that time passes, and in same with the auteur theory, all this time passes and we simplify things because it's easiest to talk about one name or one time period. And that demarcation that the 60s weren't the 60s, the 60s were the following 8 months or whatever was, I think is a very interesting stance to take, and so relevant to this issue of timing that persists throughout this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And that it's notable that Fonda is the star of Easy Rider, which is just one of those things that's pointed to as like, look at the 60s, this is the 60s, yeah. Look at it, you know. And even more, like, there are way more memorable or better films that were made in that time period, but that's still a, it's something that's remembered specifically because of how current it was at the time. And I think it's the fact that it was so current has helped it age poorly for somebody like myself, but keeps it as this iconic film just because it was so, so deeply 1969, you know?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So what about, I don't think Fonda's, I mean, a very typical villain in this, and maybe this isn't so much about a straightforward good versus evil kind of role, but how do you perceive him as the villain here?
The villain in the case that Wilson is the hero is that, you're right, like his act is, primarily accidental, and then he covers up a murder. You know, so like, he's villainous in the fact that he hits a woman. He never intended to kill her, but he still killed her, you know, and that's a type of villainy. But outside of that, he's just sort of a rich person that happens to be like to find a way to get more rich by doing a drug deal, you know. And I don't know, that's a type of villainy that doesn't really affect me, so I guess I don't care all that much about it. Whereas, you know, I want Wilson and Jenny to have a happy life together, whether or not that would have even be possible if she was still alive. But so yeah, his villainy is primarily accidental, but he does still cover up a murder, and also he kills a woman, so he's villainous in those ways.
Okay,
but he is not like a Bond villain, you know, like but it's not, I don't know. This movie doesn't feel to me like this sort of typical, we have our hero, we have our villain sort of movie. So I guess I just didn't even put a lot of thought into it, just because I think everybody's sort of in the middle, you know?
And does that detract from the hero's journey at all? Or is that irrelevant because that's information he also doesn't know?
I don't think it detracts from the movie to me at all. I think if anything, it makes it more interesting, just because it's different. You know, it's not,
yeah,
it's not that, that cackling rich man, you know? And I just,
yeah,
he's a more uncommon character. And, that's part of, I think, the appeal of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, we have the, Avery eventually hires out. I mean, I don't want to call him mustache twirling, because the hitman they find is not exactly like a calculated, Bond villain either.
Yeah. What, Nicky Cat you're talking about?
Yeah, he's more flippant and, I mean, even for the 90s, painfully homophobic gentleman. But like he kind of stands in for a more easily hateable, because I don't find Avery to be, you know, unpleasant. You know, he's maybe rough around the edges, has a job maybe I don't want, but isn't, as you said, like this cackling form of villainy. And yeah, I think Katz kind of fills that role.
Yeah, I agree. And I think something that points out what you're saying about how not a typical villain Terry Valentine is like, sometimes Avery will use a term that, you know, we would expect in a movie like this. Like the one I remember is Avery describing what Wilson has done in that warehouse, and he says they took them out, he took them out, and Valentine says to him, "Took them out? What the fuck does that mean?" Like, it's just sort of like, this is movie slang and I'm not a movie villain, you know? Yeah. And there are a couple instances of that, and just in general, there are little elements of flavor to Terry Valentine's character that separate him. And another really great moment that isn't what I'm talking about, but is kind of a cousin of it, is when they're just watching Access Hollywood and eating nuts from the bowl, and he's giving Avery shit for putting the shells back in the bowl. Like, it's just, I don't know. There's just something so normal about that. And I don't know. Those are the things that I think separate Valentine. And in a movie where we're given just shards of people, like we're never really given a full picture of anybody, those are the things that are able to separate it from just being a something that could have conceivably been a very boring story, not unlike Point Blank could have been, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it might soften him a little, but it doesn't flatten him.
No, like exactly.
it changes the way that we think about him as a counterpoint to Wilson, but it fleshes him out in a way that we rarely get to have that character fleshed out, right?
Yeah, exactly. It makes him less villainous but more of a character, and that's cool.
Yeah. That is.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about something else.